This is your tech news briefing for Wednesday, June 3rd. I'm Kateri Yoakum for The Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal held its second annual gathering on health technology yesterday. Virtually, of course. We brought executives and experts together for interactive conversations about the future of global health and how tech can help us confront the next stages of the pandemic. On today's episode, we're going to bring you one of the conversations from that event. Our editor-in-chief, Matt Murray, interviewed Instagram co-founder Kevin Systrom about his pandemic passion project, epidemiological modeling, and got his take on social media's role during the pandemic and the current nationwide protests. We'll hear from them after these headlines. We talked yesterday about how many people have been turning to social media for real-time updates from protests over the death of George Floyd. Now we report that a number of Facebook pages use the platform's live feature to post misleading or inflammatory videos. Many of those pages were actually operated from other countries, and the videos they posted were widely shared. In one case, a page operated out of Pakistan posted a video showing police officers kneeling on the back of a black man's head. But the video was not from the recent protests. It was 2 years old. Even so, it garnered 1.6 million views. Facebook took down some of the phony pages after the journal flagged them, and a spokesperson said its employees were working around the clock to find and remove content on the platform that violates its policy. But our reporter Jeff Horwitz says the incidents highlight the way social media companies are struggling to balance the fight against misinformation with maintaining free speech on the platform.
From Facebook's perspective, one of the things that makes this really difficult is that unlike, say, medical misinformation, what the sources of truth are is changing minute by minute. And, you know, whether a video is coming out of a protest or is potentially years old turns out to not be something that is necessarily obvious on first glance. So, I mean, their concern is that they limit accurate information and basically prevent unknown voices from emerging and sharing sort of important news. And the company definitely justified restraint in sort of policing things just because they really don't want to be preventing people from connecting with their communities at a time like this.
The issue of free speech on Facebook has been a big topic within the company as well. On Monday, hundreds of Facebook employees staged a virtual walkout over CEO Mark Zuckerberg's decision to allow two of President Trump's posts to remain on the platform. The posts included racially charged language about the protests, and employees said they violated Facebook policies about inciting violence. Two software engineers publicly said they quit the company in part because of what they called Facebook's failure to enforce its own rules when it comes to Trump. On Tuesday, that was a big topic at the company's town hall meeting, where Jeff Horwitz says Zuckerberg defended his decision to let the post stay up.
Employees who were there have told us it was pretty raw with a lot of people at the town hall, basically questioning how Mark Zuckerberg came to this decision, who he consulted with, and, you know, whether he understood the context for a phrase like, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, which was part of the president's post to both Facebook and Twitter. You know, when it ended, definitely some employees weren't satisfied. Some went straight to Twitter, in fact, to make clear that, you know, leadership refuses to stand with us, to quote one engineer.
The Trump administration said Tuesday it's taking steps to prepare tariffs against a wide range of U.S. trading partners overseas unless they back off proposals to tax digital services. Many U.S. trading partners have proposed or implemented the measures as a way to tax commerce on the internet. The Trump administration argues that the taxes would unfairly target U.S. companies and says it wants to defend them from such, quote, discrimination. It's a repeat of a tactic that the administration pursued against France last year, threatening tariffs on $2.4 billion worth of goods. In the end, France agreed to postpone their digital services tax until at least the end of 2020. And Zoom raised its full-year sales outlook on Tuesday after it more than doubled sales in the first quarter. There's, of course, been a surge in use as more people work remotely during the pandemic. That's brought a higher profile to Zoom, but it's also exposed security and safety shortcomings that the company is now rushing to address. Competitors like Microsoft Teams and Google Meet have also seen surges in recent months. After the break, our editor-in-chief, Matt Murray, in a teleconference with Kevin Systrom, a co-founder of Instagram. That's next. Like we said earlier, the Journal had a virtual gathering on health technology yesterday. And today, as a special treat, we're sharing one of our many conversations with global health and tech leaders from the event. Our editor-in-chief, Matt Murray, spoke with Kevin Systrom, who co-founded Instagram in 2010. Here's their conversation.
So during the last 10 weeks while I've been here in quarantine, I've basically been burning banana bread, letting the dishes pile up in my sink, and spending a lot of time watching old sitcom clips on Facebook, actually, Facebook video. You have been doing something a little bit different during this time, which shows your ambition. You've been learning about epidemiology, and you've launched a new website inspired by the virus. So can tell us about your project and how you got into it and what you're trying to achieve here.
Sure. So first I'll just say what we launched. What we launched was RT.live, and it's a website that allows you to see effectively how fast COVID-19 is spreading U.S. state by U.S. state. And RT is a metric that literally just means how many people get sick from one individual that got sick before. So Matt, if you were sick, how many people do you infect over the course of your infection? So it's effectively a multiplier. And when RT is greater than one, it means that the infection grows. And the higher RT is, the more unbounded it grows. If it's under one, that's your target, the infection slows down and eventually stops. And as I was doing my research on different metrics and different papers that support data science as it relates to COVID, I asked myself, what's the one metric that if I led a state or the country or a country, what metric would I use to manage this crisis? And it came down to RT, the metric I just described. So that's what I created with my co-founder, Mike, from Instagram. You know, it's not our new company or anything, but it is a public service. The idea that we can show people how quickly this thing is spreading state by state.
Well, why were you reading? Did you have it in mind right early on? Or did you know anything about epidemiology at all going in? Or did you just think early on, I want to understand this better? Did you come as a hobbyist? Did you come in with the idea that there might be something to do?
So I think there are different few frames to look at. First, as a technologist and one that sold a company and made some money, of course, you start donating immediately to causes. And once you write those checks and you support those programs and those individuals, you ask yourself, okay, money goes so far, but what can I do as an individual using my resources, my knowledge, my network to create something that would be of value to society? And the idea was that if we could create effectively the dashboard we would want to manage this, that would be the most helpful. So I've always been into data science. This is the other frame. And although I haven't studied epidemiology, in a week, you can spend a bunch of hours reading through papers written by all the leading epidemiologists and the methods that are used to identify how fast an infection is growing or not. All I had to do and my co-founder had to do was implement that in a way that actually took publicly available data, it brought that in, and then it produced a site that was publicly accessible. And that's something that we do for a living, right?
You talk about publicly available data. How good is the data? I mean, I think one of the big things that's been a challenge in certainly for us in writing about it, but in everybody understanding the disease is there's a lot of variability in the data from state to state, from country to country. How high quality is the data, and where it's not high quality, how have you accounted for that?
Right. So I'm going to say a couple of things. One is my background in technology is one that usually relies on almost perfect data. That is to say that if you're running Instagram and you look into the logs of Instagram, that data is almost perfect in the sense that, you know, you don't question its validity generally. Now, take a step out and now you're relying upon perhaps hundreds of different, you know, labs to report their positive and total tests on a given time frame, and you're relying on doctors to be able to call those, you know, the health departments to report positive tests. There are delays, and there's noise, and there's a bunch of crud that makes data really, it makes any given individual very skeptical of whether or not we can read any information in this. But what I'll say is this, anyone with a background in statistics understands that there's value in data, regardless of how noisy it is. All you have to do is effectively back out the noise or characterize the noise to some extent such that you can back out the true signal. And there are entire fields of statistics dedicated to taking signals from noisy sensors, we'll call it, right? And backing out the true signal. There's an entire branch of something called a Kalman filter that does this. But the idea that we took was, let's take this noisy data, let's take this quote unquote unreliable data, let's normalize it for the amount of testing that goes on, and let's denoise it as well using, you know, very accepted methodologies that statisticians have used for years and years and years. And let's back that out and get the true signal behind it. I think that's one of the things we're doing that very few other folks have done so far. And it gives us a view into the data that I think is more clear and precise than we would have otherwise.
And I think you guys early on thought that the data was telling you that there'd be more cases here than in China, well before that was clear. Is that right? So you saw some things pretty early on. Given where we're at right now, what is your data telling you about the path of coronavirus in the U.S., how far we've come, and what we still could be seeing out there? Or I guess I'd say, what are we likely to be still facing out there?
So I want to answer that question directly, but I'm going to answer a slightly different question first, which is, you know, why spend all this time on projecting where we are versus where we're going? So RT Live is interesting because it's purely backwards looking. It doesn't actually try to predict the future. It tries to just say what happened. Early on, you know, we did try to do some forecasting, and immediately we realized that this core metric RT actually, it dictates how the infection grows in the future. And as we asked ourselves, how do we predict what happens to RT? We realized we had very few options, because how do I predict when a state will open? How do I predict how defensible people will be about their space once a state opens? I honestly can't. And I think it's important intellectually to understand what you can and cannot, you know, reasonably forecast. So we decided instead to focus exactly on what you just asked, which is, how is it going? And what have we learned about what has happened and the efficacy of things like shutdowns and reopenings? So I'll say two things. One is, you can't look at a single metric for an entire country. There's not one infection. There are, you know, 51 infections if you count DC, and even more if you count, you know, counties, right? And these things are fairly localized. So you have to look at it at a local basis. And what you see when you look at a local basis is that generally shutdowns have helped tremendously. It's brought that R value below one, which means the infection has slowed. But what we have also seen is, in almost every case, when a state reopens, that line of R goes right up to one, and sometimes in many cases above one, which is not good news. And the question is that a short-term effect, or is that something that will last and maybe even grow in magnitude as we open states? And my concern is of the second wave that we're going to see in specific localities that both have a high number of people that are already infected and an R value above one. That's the deadly combination that we have to look out for. And that's what we've learned.
Is the data at this point deep enough and malleable enough that it can give you specific insights into specific policies? As an example, and people would say things, and I think one of the problems is we're all over the map, but people would say things like, we don't need to lock everything down, but sensible masks for most people, a close watch on nursing home populations, certain focus in certain areas, but not the full lockdown. Are you in a place where you can make broader, specific policy conclusions or recommendations based on what we've seen?
I won't claim that we're ever in a place to personally make policy recommendations. I think that my hope is that policymakers and experts alike take our data as one data point of many data points that they're getting, and triangulate to understand what reality is and make an informed decision. That being said, the next step in our model, we have basically a new version that we're going to be launching that I think is much more precise and much more accurate. But the next step after that on our roadmap is to involve something called covariates. And without going into the statistics of it, what that effectively means is, It says, hey, listen, you have mobility data from, say, Apple. Put that data into the model and try to understand what correlates with, say, people going more to a beach or more to arts and entertainment or more to, you know, shopping centers or you name it, right? What is it that people do when they're out and about in the different categories of things? And can you effectively identify a magnitude of a magnifier, right, associated with each of those types of activities that affects R? And is there a causal relationship there? Which is effectively to say, what are the things that we're doing that are most harmful to making the disease spread? That's the simple way of saying it. But that we can do mathematically, and that's on the roadmap. But I wouldn't say we're in a place, you know, as data scientists, we love to crunch data and display data, but we are not epidemiologists and we are not policymakers. And of course, I have my own personal opinions, but it's not my job to broadcast my personal.
Yeah, it sounds like there's not a clear enough yet strong enough empirical data recommendations, for instance, here. There's informative data, but it's up to policymakers to sort of take that and interpret it.
Well, and I don't want to hand wave too much here, but I do want to say that there is a very clear correlation between being open and having an R above one, for sure, hands down, right? So the question is it worth being shut down? What are the other costs that this model is not taking into account, both human, economic, et cetera? And that's where we want to be a data point in the toolbox for a policymaker, not necessarily the only tool.
Let's talk a little bit about the Valley. And I want to remind everybody, RT Live is not it's not a commercial venture at this point. It's a public service site. So we're not talking in the context of this being a commercial venture, but healthcare has been one of those areas that technologists have talked about reinventing for a long, long time. And that sort of hope that the promise of technology would mean we would get more efficient healthcare, we'd get better data, we'd get better service, we'd bring costs down. And for all the impact technology's had on our lives in the last 20 or 30 years, that we haven't really seen that kind of technology breakthrough on a macro level. Is the event that we're living through now, people are getting into health again, Google's talking about it, is it going to propel an innovation wave here that will really change the dynamics of how technology and health interact and could be transformative? Can you see that coming out of this?
I mean, absolutely. But I'd like to maybe state for the record that I actually do believe that Silicon Valley has been super interested in the world of health for quite a long time. I remember working at Google in their corporate development department. Every corporate development person had their areas to focus on, and mine was health. So I spent a lot of time with Google health folks way back in the day. I mean, it was probably 2009, let's call it 2008. And I remember looking at companies in that space that were doing super interesting work and still are, everything from, you know, call it ZocDoc all the way up through Fitbit. At the same time, we're not yet at a place where we figured out a way to commercialize it. So if you look around, you know, Fitbit's a fairly large company, but it's not Instagram or Facebook size in terms of revenues. The question is there a company in there that can be that large? And I think the answer is yes, but you need a bunch of catalyzing events to happen. So one, you need context where people care enough. I think that's true now. And two, you need a shift in technology that allows for people to build interesting things. And I think you're probably starting to see that with wearables and all the sensors that are coming out.
In that space broadly, if you thought in the broader sense, do you see a specific job or two needing to be done right now where you could see a Google or an entrepreneur moving in?
I had this conversation recently with a handful of entrepreneurs and a handful of investors. And I think the big question is, if you're going to start a company focused on coronavirus-related activity, what is your bet? Is your bet that this is around for the next 2 to 3 to 4 years in a massive way, and that this is one pandemic of many to come, and perhaps we'll need infrastructure or apps or policies or programs that will just be adopted from now on from various companies trying to deal with this pandemic? Are you going to need that for the next, you know, many, many years as a company develops? Or does this thing go away in a year because of a vaccine or weather or whatever people like to believe? Are we in a place where there is not actually a commercial opportunity. And the jury is out. This sounds strange, but I sincerely hope there's not a business opportunity. I sincerely hope this goes away. At the same time, I understand why entrepreneurs are taking a look and saying, hey, forget about making money. We can have an enormous impact by focusing on keeping people healthy. And it's clear to me there's likely a range, and it's probably not coronavirus specific, and it's likely not, hey, let's just focus on exercise, but rather somewhere in between where people are far more health conscious than they were in the past. But again, like every entrepreneur, I'm taking a look at the area and saying, what are the opportunities? There's no clear picture yet. And I think it's going to take quite some time before we see anything.
So I have to ask you about social media in two ways. We are, of course, through the coronavirus, and now with the demonstrations around the country and the George Floyd story, as well as the riots, the looting, we are seeing social media's impact on our society in all kinds of ways, sharing information and sharing misinformation, in stoking debates and bringing people together. And of course, right now we've got specific context of Twitter having one policy about the president's tweets, Facebook having another policy about the president's tweets. Is social media good generally at these moments, or have we let a genie out of the bottle? And what do you think is the right approach on controversial things like political tweets, like Twitter and Facebook have been discussing?
I'll say a couple things. First and foremost, I remember sitting down with Mike, my co-founder, and a notebook in front of us. And we had been working on a company that it wasn't going well. And that was the first version before Instagram came about, right? And we had that notebook open, and we were sketching down ideas. And I distinctly remember sitting with him and saying, there is a transition happening, a transformation happening, where social media is mostly on the desktop now. Remember, this is 2010. Mostly on the desktop, people are sharing links, they're sharing videos, but now all of a sudden, everyone's walking around with a phone in their pocket. And that phone is their new computer, right? People are on their desktop, but it's now, that's an email and web browsing machine. Most of your computing is gonna happen with the device in your pocket. And that device in your pocket happens to have a camera. So the question is, what does social media look like for the next 10 or 20 years? And it likely isn't on the desktop, and it likely isn't just sharing links. It's likely sharing your real life. Now, what we didn't understand was that by creating Instagram, we would give a voice to over a billion people. And we called it a visual voice because, of course, you can say something in a caption, or you can tweet, or you can post on Facebook. But the power of being able to post an image or something in a story, right? The power of an image to compel and move people was something that we wanted to harness. And we didn't quite understand how powerful that would be at the beginning. As time went on and as we grew the company, what we began to realize was that was an enormously powerful tool for people to be heard. I am enormously proud of Instagram's impact in the world and how it affects the overall conversation on these topics. Because let's take a step back for a second. Would you have seen the video of George Floyd without social media? And I think the answer is likely no. So not only does it allow us to access information in a more democratic way that isn't censored, that is right, but it also allows us to express our discontent or our content about specific issues. So I actually think, by and large, to answer your question directly, I think it is a force for good. And does that have side effects? And does that have very complicated questions related to it? Absolutely. But I don't think that overshadows the power of social media.
Do you think, I mean, again, you ran a company for a long time. You may not be comfortable talking about a specific company now, but what is the answer on companies' responsibilities or duties on controversial content, misinformation, or you know, politically sensitive points? We are seeing an array of views. We see Mark Zuckerberg under fire from some of his employees. We see Jack Dorsey under fire in his way, different views. Do we have an answer? Do we know what the right approach is? Do you have a view on how to manage something like that?
Well, if you take a step back and you look, let's say, at countries, forget about technology companies for a second. Let's just look at countries. Every country has different rules about how to engage about information, different standards about what is and isn't allowed in the press. So to say that there's one rule that applies equally to every human on Earth, I think my prior is that that's not true. And that generally what communities do or civilization will, they'll make up their norms, they'll codify those norms as laws, and then those become standard within a given country or culture. But at the same time, what we have is unprecedented in that Instagram, Facebook, Twitter are all, they're not a single culture. They span cultures. And one of the most difficult jobs I had as CEO of Instagram was realizing that I had to make decisions on content with my viewpoint, knowing full well that, say, in Brazil, they have a different viewpoint on that same content.
And it sounds like, I mean, again, I don't want to infer. It sounds like, and I know you're not issuing a judgment particularly on it, but it sounds like part of what you're saying is it's helpful if there's a clear societal framework in which to operate for the deciders. And that, and
yes.
I guess that implies a government, some kind of government or policy action that creates that framework. Is that fair?
I guess what I'd say is it's unprecedented to have to make a decision that affects people in every single country and every single culture, all of which have different laws and expectations. And to have to make a single policy on a single platform, I think is a very difficult job, because no matter what you do, some group is going to be underserved. But what I would say is it is likely in the best interest of leaders of these companies to be pragmatic in a time where people are in an enormous amount of pain, and the country, specifically the US, I'll speak for the US just because I live here, is in an enormous amount of pain. We have, you know, over 100,000 people dead from a pandemic that likely could have been managed better in all respects. I'm not pointing fingers at any individual. And we have this event with George Floyd that I think pokes at something that has been simmering for a very, very long time, and a pain that everyone feels deeply. And to be a leader in that moment, I think you have to be fairly pragmatic and realize that sometimes your principles can feel, it can make situations more difficult. Let's put it that way. But at the same time, I think this is a difficult job, and I commend the people for trying to figure out the right answer.
Okay. I wish we could go on. I think we're out of time if I'm reading our complicated dashboard of our virtual event. I probably am not. So, but thanks for all of your thoughts. Appreciate hearing from you on RT Live. So thank you.
And that was your tech news briefing. We hope you enjoyed that conversation. There are more on our website, wsj.com. If you like our podcast, you can rate and review us in your app store. And if you want more news about Wall Street Journal podcasts, you can follow us on Twitter at WSJ Podcasts. I'm Kateri Yoakum for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.